welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by data protection people. My name is Ollie Rear, and I'm joined for the purposes of this intro, for the first time in a while, actually, because we've both been on leave, but by Miles Dacres. Hello, Miles.
Hello, Ollie. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It has been a while, and even more bizarrely, you and I, and let's be completely honest with the listener, you and I are recording this like 3 weeks after the original episode was recorded initially, so it's a little bit odd for us, and we're doing this on a Thursday. It's all a bit odd, but we thought we'd record you a little intro, because basically Miles and I went on leave, which, you know, we're entitled to do, but we left Phil and Dave down to do the podcast, and so we're sort of dealing with that retrospectively, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. So I think it'll be quite evident to anybody who's a regular listener of Data Protection Made Easy that Ollie is the ringmaster of these sessions, and he normally keeps people reined in. So you can imagine in our absence that we did let Phil and Dave run wild for the first time ever on these sessions. So I hope you enjoy the discussion, and it's a little bit more unhinged than it is normally when you are present.
Well, yeah, let's hope it's still a good one. I'm looking forward to hearing it because I've not heard it yet, so I'll listen to this when it goes out fully. This is, I believe, episode 64 of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. It's an episode of GDPR Radio, so it's open surgery. This is, for those who were specifically interested, dated, I think, the 4th of March. It was that session if you were on it. As ever, if you want to get involved with future sessions, you'd like to come on live and discuss something, then do get in touch, reach out to us on any of the socials, Miles in particular, but any of our biz dev guys, or just generally get in touch with the info at email. We'll get back to you and you can get an invite to come along. If you've got any suggestions, either for a topic specifically that you'd like us to cover, or more generally on how we can improve the podcast going forwards, we're always looking for feedback, good or bad. It helps us to improve the show. And ultimately, that's in everyone's interest. Last thing before, well, at least I think it's last thing, Miles. Well, you're welcome to chip in with anything that needs to needs explaining on this. But the last thing, and I nag everyone for this every week, but I'm going to keep doing it until we get a strong rating, is if you're listening on any particular streaming platform, please, please, please give us a rating. Whatever the rating is, it really helps, you know, and it increases the exposure of the podcast. It increases the number of people we get coming along. It improves the content as a result, and therefore everyone benefits. I think that's about it from me, Miles. Anything else before we
just a final point from me, from anybody who is listening, to make them aware that we do now have an events page on our website as well. The events page has the list of all the upcoming events. It's got further detail than you might see on LinkedIn or any other social channel. So if you are wanting to know about what we will be discussing, what key speakers we have coming on, and the topics that we'll be covering, then all of that will be explained in the events page. You can also tailor or sort the events page based on what sector you're working in. So we do have sector specific sessions for, say, education sector, for housing, for local authorities, and so on and so forth. So you can really pick and choose what events you want to come to in the future. So yeah, head over to our website and have a look at the list of the events that we have lined up over the next couple of months, because we have some good ones on the horizon. That's all from me, Ollie. Other than that, I think we can get cracking, really.
Yeah, nice one. Thanks. And that's a very good point, just in terms of continuity. So we're recording this, obviously, after it initially went out. We're also recording this after we did our Hot Topics for Hospices episode, all about fundraising in the charity sector generally, but specifically in the context of hospices. That was a really good session. I think that recording is going out later today, or going out very soon anyway. And the next live session we're doing will be tomorrow, as of the time of us recording this, which is the 18th of March. That again is an episode of GDPR Radio. Come along if you want to chat all things data protection and privacy. On that note, I'm going to hand over the proverbial floor to Phil Brining and David Holmes, and hopefully it all goes well. I look forward to hearing it when it comes out.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
We mentioned, has the IDTAs come out, the international data transfers? Has anybody read them? If anybody listening that's read them, I've had a quick look at some of the blogs and bits and pieces that are on about them. Have you come across them specifically, Phil?
I have, but as I said at the start, I'm waiting for them to become a kind of officially adopted. So I know it's due this month. I can't remember when or if there's a specific date, but you know, we want to know that they've been, you know, officially adopted, don't we? Then we can get on with them.
For sure. So there's two bits to it, I think, as it was laid. So you got the IDTAs, and you get the addendum that you can append to the SCCs. So it'll be interesting to see what the details of there will look like. There's also a slight leading process. So I think we've got a couple of years to convert over to them for any operating under the old standard at the moment. But anything new moving forward from about September this year must operate under IDTAs, I think.
Mm.
And that's about the extent of what I've caught up with them so far.
Yeah. So what have we been doing this week? I was doing some auditing this week, which was really fun. I really like going out and doing data protection auditing. It's been good. And I've got involved with a couple of cases in the support desk. One was about data sharing. There's a complaint in Greece about one of our clients who've got somebody's complained about their CCTV coverage, which meant I had to have a look at the Hellenic Data Protection Authority's website, which is all Greek to me, and some of the breaches around information. So again, I've had quite an interesting week looking at that type of stuff. And the audit was good because, you know, this company was saying, you know, well, we haven't got anything in place. But when you start poking about, you do find some stuff, you know, that they've either forgotten about or don't know that they've got. So like most of the things, you know, somebody's done a lot of work, a legal firm done a load of work in 2018, and then it's all just been left, you know, so it's not implemented and not updated, which is often what we find, isn't it?
So what gave rise to the audit then? Was it kind of
have requested it. So there's been an acquisition. This company has been merged with two others to form a new company, then been bought by another company, and that other company wants some kind of assurances around GDPR compliance.
That's after it was purchased and not part of the due diligence measures.
After it's been purchased, yeah.
Okay.
And interesting is kind of the person who's been asked to give the assurances and therefore commission the audit is the head of IT. He's getting IT under control, replacing systems and things. He just wants some external, you know, input on compliance with particular GDPR, but a little bit on the PECA as well.
Okay. So other than the fact that they kind of addressed some things around data protection a few years ago and it's not maintained them in line with NOE, so we like cyclical audits and bits and pieces, very similar to the 27,000 framework. That was very much we've done something, forgotten about it, not addressed it since kind of approach. Was there anything else that fell out of that then? That was quite interesting. Anything that
They're doing quite a lot of profiling. So they've got about 3 million customers and they're doing quite a lot of profiling, but you know, haven't done a DPA on it because it's got no process or procedure for that or policy on it. They've got no central data protection compliance management policy. You know, so the sort of thing that covers all of the requirements and says, you know, we're gonna do this, you know, and there's a procedure to explain how we're gonna do it. So nothing like that to give them overall control. Again, we often find there isn't. And a mishmash of privacy information. Again, I did an audit a couple of weeks ago, and there was a 26-page privacy notice, which was, you know, unbelievable. 6,700 words, unbelievably long.
Was it put together as part of some university coursework?
It was put together again by a legal team, you know, and it wasn't easy to navigate. It did have kind of concertina pieces on it, but you know, you get to a point where there's so much information, it's not transparent anymore, isn't it?
It's quite an interesting point, though, because could you argue then that that's actually dissuasive?
No, I would do, yeah, and I did do, you know, and I'm not sure whether the ICO or any other supervisory authority would do, but, you know, again, why put yourself in the position where you might have people chipping away at your privacy information because of the way it's been structured? The other thing is that the international company, I mean, I don't know if you noticed the Dutch Data Protection Authority fined a company a few months ago for having only having their privacy information in English. They issued a fine.
Yeah.
So again, I was saying, well, you know, if you've got operations in other countries, you need, different language, you need to ensure that you're catering for that. And in some countries, of course, it might be like Belgium, there might be three or four different languages you might not want to put your privacy information in.
No, for sure. And it comes back to, I know we discussed it previously when you're looking at privacy information and things about how you put it together, how you produce it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in Word format either. And I've certainly seen some interesting examples. I think Channel 4 did it with their privacy notice. And it was
Alan Carr. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the best one I saw, like, that was EasyJets. EasyJets was done like the flight takeoff thing. It was really good. If you have it, it's probably on YouTube. But they'd done the privacy notice, you know, and it was an air steward, you know, giving the privacy information in the aisle of the plane. It was really well put together.
I thought you were going to say it's like EasyJet. This privacy information, we have to pay extra for it.
No, they know their Article 12. Anyway, sorry, I'm rabbiting on here, but I did have a look at something. I was trying to find out about the Greek fine, €30,000 for insufficient fulfillment of information obligations. Again, I opened the link and it was a PDF all in Greek. They're really hard to, I suppose I could put it into a portal to translate it, but I didn't do. I might do later.
Yeah, I had a quick nosy on the ICO's enforcement page, if there's anything new on there, and they're still chasing cookies and that kind of thing. Or at least Pekka infringements, if not cookies.
I was having a look through the data sharing code of practice earlier in the week as well with one of our consultants, and really having a look at, you know, it's quite good. But then you get, I don't know if anybody's seen it, but you get to Annex A, the data sharing checklist. And again, this is quite good as well. So these things to consider before entering into a data sharing arrangement. But then, you know, a little bit further on, it says, and this is what should be in a data sharing agreement. And, you know, it starts off okay, but then I struggle with that. I don't know if anybody else has kind of been through this. So if you decide to share, it's good practice, are you not legal requirement, to have a data sharing agreement, as well as considering the points above, blah, 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 you know, you should ensure you cover these matters in the data sharing agreement, whether or not you have a formal agreement in place. So again, that bit is all quite helpful, isn't it? Because it's saying you don't have to have a formal agreement in place, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, it's going into, you know, for instance, who is it going to get shared with? And you think, well, what if I've got personnel changes? Or what if I don't know? You know, how are you going to build that into an agreement? You know, a legally binding agreement. And so I kind of came to a conclusion, it's quite good guidance, well, interesting guidance, but, you know, the way it's phrased in that Annex A, I thought, you know, a lot of room for improvement. But I'm also reading their comments about our housing code of conduct. It's a 74-page document, and there's a ton of comments. They've made some really good comments and observations, you know, really helpful, the ICO. So we're writing the code of conduct for the social housing industry. And it has to go through the ICO for approval, and they've come back. You know, they've spent a lot of time, and you know, they know their stuff, undoubtedly. Sometimes you don't think so when you look at their website, but you know, they're a good team and they put some good stuff together. So hopefully we'll be able to take those comments forward and you know, make sure this code of conduct is a really good piece of work for the industry.
Have we got a timeline for that, for when that's going to be completed?
We're meant to be trying to, you see, after we've incorporated the ICO's initial comments, it's going to go out to consultation in Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales and England into a representative sample of social housing providers. And we're aiming to try and get the whole thing wrapped up by the Housing Governance Conference in June. But I'm not sure we will, because we still haven't made a final decision on what to do about the monitoring body. But that's what we're working towards.
Be useful just to have a read through the ICO's comments. Maybe not now, but to go through myself just to see where they
put yourself some time aside at the weekend. Get yourself a few strong black coffees, it's in the code of conduct teams. So have you read this data sharing code of practice?
I went through it a while ago. I've not been through it recently. I went through it a while ago, and it's not a recent thing, is it? I think it was out earlier in the year, back into last year, something like that. I think it was.
It's one with two arrows on it. Again, with everything, I find it really hard to find the right guidance. And if you look at the website, it doesn't follow, with all the HTML stuff. I like to work with the PDFs because it follows a flow. But when you're looking at the website stuff, I don't find it that helpful, actually, the ICO guidance on the website. The PDF stuff is much better. You can print it off. You can write all over it. You can, annotate it and stuff. But the web stuff, I know it's easier for them to maintain and keep up to date. But when you're actually searching for the Go to Practice, you get all sorts of different references, and you've got to know which is the latest one.
No, for sure. I found that when I was looking at something else, I still reference old documents, which might not have been updated, but you can get yourself lost a little bit with it. I do like the PDFs that you can print out. So that was interesting. Something I got tied up in a little bit this week was looking at working with a charity. They wanted to, as with a lot of charities that initially jumped and went straight behind consent back to, 17, 18 now, I think it was. They're trying to unpick consent for postal communications and move on to legitimate interests. Some of the stats were quite shocking, though. Just a reduction in the size of the data from somewhere around about 31,000 down to 4,500. And analysis shows that all new data supporters, only 24% of new people signing up actually consent, which got me thinking of it, really, not so much about the charity itself, but just about opt-in and opt-outs. And you can look at that within the our sector, or you can look at in other areas. For example, with the national kind of organ donation register, where you had to opt in and had low numbers, and they turned it around and said, well, you're all opted in unless you opt out. And the numbers swelled with the number of people that are on the data because of how people perceive opt-in and opt-outs. And I just thought the stats that they were kind of providing was quite interesting.
Yeah.
In that sense, and how it works. And it kind of reiterates back with individuals when we've been through cookie compliance, or at least clients when I've been through cookie compliance with them, that their marketing teams then get all upset with themselves, quite rightfully, that they've lost a lot of tracking. And you can say, well, that's kind of an obvious output when you're saying to people, do you want this, yes or no? Most people will say no, and that's kind of another obvious output from that. So it's just another thing from that kind of just caught my eye with the interest in the stats.
Yeah, I've just been looking at Ben. So Ben's put in the visual privacy notices from Chichester College, and I've just had a quick look. I mean, they're really good. I mean, this is the sort of thing that just 1,000, or 6,700 words condensed into a 5-minute video. I mean, brilliant, really well put together. And I think, really useful for, the target audience, the students. They're going to consume this much more readily than reading some long, boring, text in a privacy notice. So that's really, thank you very much for sharing that, Ben. That's really good. I'm really impressed with that. I noticed on the international transfers there's kind of a location beacon in the middle of the Atlantic. So I'm wondering where that is. Maybe it's a submarine or something, or your yacht, maybe. Or is that wishful thinking? So if you haven't looked at it, it's in the chat. I would have a look at that, because it's really good stuff. And Rick talking about, I haven't seen that the ICO has reprimanded NHS Scotland misuse of data collected from COVID status app. Again, that'll be interesting to have a look through that.
One thing that I saw was interesting for two reasons. It was shared on LinkedIn that by the Daily Mail, of all people, that there's a couple of loos at a court battle over the neighbour's mannequin looking through their house. I don't know if you've seen that. They had a skylight put in this. He stood a mannequin in the skylight, so it looked like it was overlooking the neighbour's property in that sense. I think it was a slightly misleading article, because I think the court case was actually over the provision of the building regs over the purpose of a skylight. But the argument in the Mail was titled about the losing a battle over the mannequin looking into their house, making it look like it's a privacy issue. The wider issue I've got, I don't know if you ever come across this. I might possibly, if I can find it, just show it. It's a little bit of a bugbear of mine at the moment. If I can just kind of share my screen slightly, just ever so briefly for a couple of minutes. And it's in relation to actually trying to read the story, as you can see here, on the Daily Mail's website with the cookie compliant banner. I'm not a cookie compliant banner, but when you say, well, I don't want to accept all of them, then you start, have you seen these? Have you seen these? Well, I don't know why you're operating under legitimate interest, but I don't want it under legitimate interest. Then when you kind of, sorry, that one's disruptive. Then when you kind of, just flipping hundreds of them.
I know there are. There are literally hundreds. I counted ones. 320 were. You know, it's ridiculous. Often, you know, I don't know who's providing this engineer, but like the OneTrust one usually has a reject all, doesn't it?
It needs a reject all, because I would have said, if you're not careful, this isn't saying consent was fairly given, because you're making it so onerous to say, no, I don't want legitimate interest to everything. I either got to leave the page and not go to the article, or I just accept all and then be subject to whatever heck Cubic does under their legitimate interest in that sense. And that's one thing that really winds me up, and that's the Daily Mail, of all people. Come on.
I do the same as Emma. If I go looking through to somebody and it throws up this complicated, I just don't bother reading the article.
No, I didn't. I left it there for the purposes, because I was looking at it earlier and I thought, well, I'll leave it there so I can raise it on the GDPR radio this afternoon. So I left it up for that purpose, but I just walk away from it. I look at that and go, if I can do a quick no, I'm not interested, that's fine. If you make it too onerous, I just don't visit the website.
Yeah, I'm just having a quick scan through as I'm trying to talk. You know, I can't do more than one thing at once. So the article that Steph's highlighted, in defence of the long privacy statement, Maryland Law Review, it's 2021, so recent, you know. Interesting. It's just the abstract we can see, but actually you can download the paper. That's probably worth having a look at, you know, just a quick read of that. So thank you for that.
Okay, so we've got popping up in the chat, because I do forget to, because I do miss Ollie when he's not here, because I don't tend to look at the chat, so I do apologise for people who are putting things there.
Yeah, just having a quick look. It's quite a long article, actually, if you download it, but worth having a read of that. Add it to your reading list, Dave, when you've read through the Housing Code of Conduct.
That's my weekend spent, then, isn't it?
So Steph's referring to the Belgians, and then other regulators have also kind of adopted this stance, about advertising, IAB. Just popping up in the chat. We talked briefly about this, didn't we, a few weeks ago?
Mm.
And I compared it to the ad tech review the ISO was doing.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing the same as me. You're reading stuff and trying to talk at the same time.
I don't do multitasking really well.
No. Right. So we've nearly run out of time if we've both got to jump off at 1 o'clock, unless somebody else wants to pick up the bat. I mean, what have you got on next week, Dave? Have you got a busy week coming up?
I'm hoping that next week's a little lighter. I've got a couple of DPO monitoring days to pick up on. I've got a little bit of work around trying to a client just needs some actions around 27,001 addressing, and then hopefully as things start to quieten down, I can start looking at some of the internal measures I need to be addressing as part of the role that I've got as within DPP. So I'm hoping we get there, but all best plans and all that. I'm sure something might come up before the end of the day that kicks me into next week a little bit further.
Yeah, it's International Women's Day on Tuesday, 8th of March. Just thought I'd throw that one in. Yeah, all right, fine. Fair enough. now, where have we got to with our DPO training course? Do you know, are you up to speed where we're up to with that? Are we doing it in June now in Milton Keynes, 5 days? Is that the plan?
I think so. I'm not sure, because we were talking about doing one remotely as well, weren't we? Going to do a remote DPO training day as well as a kind of first-to-first training one. So I think, yes, I think there is one in Milton Keynes in June. I'm just not sure if the one in March was due to go ahead, or if it's still going ahead.
No, remotely. I think that was going to be in York physically, but it's not now. I think those people wanted to do push it into the next financial year. So I think they've all kind of moved into the June one, which is fine. But I don't think we've got anything remote. But again, we're interested in people's views, really, because we've got we wanted to do a really, really good immersive kind of data protection, effectively officers training course. And we envisaged that, you know, it would work best if people, you know, attended it physically, and you know, if they stayed in a hotel and we could spend the whole week just talking and thinking about you know, data protection. But I think the feedback from the industry is generally, you know, no, we don't want to travel. We've, you know, got used to doing things on Teams. We want to do it spread over a number of weeks. So again, we're kind of wanting to hear back from the market, really. So, you know, if we were going to do, you know, a very, very comprehensive, you know, piece of training for privacy practitioners at that kind of level, you know, how is it best to get it delivered? So if you got any thoughts, we'd be welcome to hear them, really. Not necessarily now, but, you know, via email or something, because some of the training that you know, we send our people off to the PDP course, because, you know, I think that's really good. But, you know, we like to, because we think we can offer a slightly different dimension to it. So we want to do our own training. So if you've got any thoughts about what you'd like us to do or how you think we should structure it, then, you know, shout up and let us know, please. So, Joe, you're saying, yeah, it's June, just a residential in June, yeah?
I think Joe's nodding with his mic on mute.
Right, okay.
Just the last couple of bits for me. Have you seen there's consultation out by the consultation by the ICO on their new guidance on processing personal data for scientific research purposes?
I have, yeah, I saw that, yeah. I'm interested to have a look at that.
Yeah, so that's up for consultation until the 22nd of April. This year, so I've got that up and as a bit to read and to go through. The other bit I thought I found is quite interesting. I've not read through it enough sufficiently for the detail, but the ICO has pushed out guidance on ransomware and data protection compliance, and there's a bit of a checklist kind of covering things like governance, asset identification, technical controls, selection access controls, vulnerability management, and so on. So I've also got, if I was up to speed, I'd be able to talk about those a lot more, but there's I've got multiple tabs open to read there on them. I just thought it was worth it, just if anybody's been through them, anybody see them, anybody's got any comments or queries and that kind of thing. But it's interesting to see that there's some additional developments coming out under John's watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Rick's saying on the chat is absolutely spot on. So, you know, you can do, you know, slides, and you can tell people about, you know, the GDPR says this, but ultimately, you know, we've got to do exercises to help people, you know, test and find the parameters around, you know, what the GDPR says, and we try and gamify as much as we can. So, you know, asking, we have breach or no breach as a game in our training, and you know, you spin the bot around, and then there's a lot of scenarios, and it's a bit like the apprentice thing. I might have said this before, where, you know, people hold up the card that says breach or no breach, and then, you know, wave it if they think it's a reportable breach. But if we can get people to, you know, engage with gamified content, then exercise like Jane Fonda, exactly, yeah. Then it just makes it a bit more memorable, I suppose, more than anything. You know, it doesn't necessarily you know, cement the learning any better, but it does make it a bit more memorable.
No, for sure. And it's also, I think, it addresses different learning styles and different learning approaches that not all individuals learn best by reading. And learn best by studying books and writing bits and pieces down. So being able to gamify it, meaning make it fun, trying to make it memorable, that kind of thing, make it sit better with them, so they actually enjoy the training. There's no point falling back into the stereotype when you hear a lot of people going, oh, data protection, it's a bit dry. So why should the training be dry? Why don't we try to liven up the training, make it fun, make it interesting, and change the concept that some have towards this element of the law?
Yeah, Michael said, "One trust driving him round the bend." I think I've got a project coming up with a company that wants us to configure and set up and load data into their One Trust platform. So again, that'd be really quite interesting to have a look at what it does and how it's structured. Oh, Mark's got his hand up. Mark, yes, hello.
Hey, right, I'm just picking up on what Dave said there, and I'm really getting quite a lot out of Ben's presentations there. Funnily enough, we're actually meeting with our teams this week, and one of the things is we're discussing is how dry the subject can be. I'm always looking for you know, new ways of presenting information. I think Ben has really, you know, picked up on something there. You know, the videos.
Great, aren't they?
They're brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. I've only just literally had a look, you know, on mute, but I'm going to be watching them, you know, quite deeply to see if what I can take away from that, because we've got to try and change the methods of getting this information across. Yeah. Because at the moment, it's just like, it's sending people to sleep, and it's a nightmare. But yeah, I think
I'll tell you what though, Mark, I don't know how Ben's done these, but we've done some training decks, and again, we've said this before, and you might not know this, but PowerPoint, you can create a slide deck and narrate it, you know, with the headphones on like this, right? And you get the voiceover, the slides, on PowerPoint, and then you can save it as an MP4. Or you can save it as a PowerPoint show. So you can package it up with the sound and the visual, vision and everything. And it's a desktop tool. You don't have to go through professional editing suites. You don't have to all that. You can do it. Now, the trouble with PowerPoint is if you get your narration wrong for that slide, you've got to start it again. So you can't edit the audio track separately from the slide. So, but if you know, what I'm saying is we have all got these tools to produce these types of things on our desktops. We just got to, I suppose, have the time and the creativity to do it.
If I can just jump in, I'm going to have to jump for this board training, but I'm happy to hand over to Mark. He's a budding DPO under my expert guidance, and I'm sure he's got some valuable content. So thank you, Mark, for just finishing off with Phil, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Dave.
Speak to you all shortly. Take care now. Bye-bye.
And, Michael, I will come to you if I need some help on getting data into the OneTrust.
I will run for the hills if you do.
Somewhere I've got a hard hat with data protection officer on it. I shall make sure I find it and put it on for that project. Now, listen, I'm afraid I've got to push off as well because I've got a meeting with a customer to talk through an order report. So I by all means, you know, stay on and chat amongst yourselves. I don't think we've ever done this before, all bail out and leave all the people to stay on. But if you want to, then by all means do. But otherwise, thanks very much for joining. I know it's been a bit of a rambling session. You know what Dave and I are like, though, so apologies if there's not much structure or information in there. But we're back next week. Ollie's back from his jollies, so it'll be probably a more structured discussion because Ollie will bring us in line. So thanks very much, everyone. Have a great weekend, and we hope to see you again next week, if not before. Thank you.
Cheers, Phil.
Cheers, see ya.